from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our second hour this morning, there's a set of complaints we hear about young people these days, that they're entitled, overpraised, and grow up thinking they're more special than they really are. But in his new book, The Myth of the Spoiled Child, writer Alfie Cohen says the barbs leveled at permissive parents and the supposedly narcissistic kids they raise are unfounded. Cohen says parents should work to raise kids with high self-esteem and that the fashionable belief that kids must develop grit and self-discipline through failure and suffering is unproven and often counterproductive. He'll join us for the hour ahead. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program, our second hour. Are most modern parents, as one often hears, over-involved and too indulgent with their children, creating packs of brats who are narcissistic and not ready or prepared for the tribulations and challenges of adulthood? Education theorist and author Alfie Cohen takes on this common held notion in his newest book, The Myth of the Spoiled Child, and he joins us for Forum's second hour. And good to have you back with us on Forum, Alfie Cohen. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
I guess I'd like to begin with the title of your book. The whole idea of proving children are more spoiled or not spoiled seems to me gets us into the real weeds of social sciences just in terms of how do you prove one way or another? I mean, it may be a myth or it may not be a myth, but where do you get empirical data from?
Well, that's a good question. And the burden of proof falls with those who make these assertions about parents being too permissive on the one hand, and somehow too over-controlling on the other hand, without any data. And if you read the articles about coddled kids and parents who don't set limits or parents who are guilty of helicopter parenting, all you find are selected anecdotes repeated endlessly with no data to support the claim that parents are more this way than another way, let alone that they're more this way than parents used to be. What we'd need would be representative national survey data to show what kind of activities are encouraged, what kind of parenting is actually done, and those data are very scarce.
Well, you point out, I think quite insightfully, that probably back to just about time immemorial, or certainly back to the time of Socrates, that there's always been this notion that the past generation looks at the future generation with some sense that they're going out of control and all that. But I'm just wondering about what we keep hearing about going from a parent-centered, because I think the data may be there, a parent-centered kind of approach to child rearing to a child-centered approach. I mean, this seems to be almost indisputable, along with the idea of maybe anecdotally helicopters or tiger moms or whatever.
No, I think it's not only disputable, I'm prepared to dispute it. I think it's hard to make a case that America is child-friendly, let alone child-centered in any meaningful sense of the term. It may be that techniques for parents to get compliance and impose their will have become jazzier or groovier or less harsh, but that doesn't mean that the center of gravity doesn't still rest completely with the parents. Now we're more likely perhaps to try to get our way with kids by praising them when they comply. Good job. I like the way you... Then by smacking them. But it's still very much about compliance. The question that's answered by the vast majority of parenting books today, as it was the case 50 years ago, is not what do kids need and how do we meet those needs? It's how do I get my kid to do what I want?
Well, maybe some of this is rested or vested largely in suburban America or exurban America, but there is this concern about an egalitarianism that's run amok with making kids feel self-pride or feel good about themselves by giving every kid a medal, for example, and giving every kid recognition. And you're saying something along the lines of that's a good thing.
Well, yes and no. In a chapter of the book, I look at a bunch of these related notions, the accusations that everything comes to kids too easily. praise and stickers and grades and trophies, and that what we really need is to make them earn their adulations and so on. And there's a deeply conservative worldview driving that fury, and it really is a fury, way out of proportion to the pervasiveness or the effects of these actual practices. Now, my view is I'm concerned about teaching kids that the only way to have fun or accomplish a goal is to defeat other kids trying to do the same thing. I think we're distracted from asking those meaningful questions about the toxicity and pervasiveness of competition when we give every kid a trophy. But I still think it's mostly a well-meaning and innocuous way to say, yeah, we appreciate your trying. After all, every kid knows who won the game at the end. But the idea that people are just driven to apoplectic fits over the idea that we wouldn't reserve the trophies only for the conquering heroes, you know, or that 90% of the kids or whatever at Harvard get A's. The notion here is that even when you get to Harvard, we still have to sort kids, so there must always be losers. That's the ideology here, I think, is far more troubling than the reality that these people purport to describe. Ultimately, the big things, the big assumptions about what we should be doing with kids, and as I said a minute ago, who needs to make the decisions and what the goal is, namely compliance, really hasn't changed. There's just kind of a patina of niceness and support. What kids really benefit from, and there's good research to support this claim, is unconditional self-esteem. The notion that even when I screw up or fall short, I still have this core of faith and belief in myself as a worthwhile person. And it's that unconditionality that I think drives social conservatives wild and reveals a great many people in our culture to have a streak of conservatism that they may not have acknowledged.
Can unconditionality lead to excess or opprobrious behavior? I mean, there have to be barriers, don't there?
Not to unconditionality. I'm not suggesting grandiosity. I'm not suggesting that we tell kids they did fine when they didn't, you know, which is a sort of caricature of this position often used to discredit it. Nor am I saying that kids shouldn't know the difference between right and wrong, between what benefits me and what benefits others. Ironically, as it will seem to some, it's that unconditional support, that sense of being loved by your parents for who you are, not for what you do, where care is never something that has to be earned. That unconditionality is what allows kids to take chances, to take risks, to push themselves, and to have their own psychological needs met so those needs aren't still ringing in their ears and they can be more alert to other people's needs. So unconditionality is not the problem, quite the reverse.
We're talking Alfie Cohen. His new book is The Myth of the Spoiled Child, challenging the conventional wisdom about children and parenting. Some of this may be, as you say, the result of a political conservatism or social conservatism, but many of these ideas about grit and self-determination are embraced by people who are otherwise liberal in their politics. What do you think is going on?
Exactly. And that's actually the paradox that drove me to write The Myth of the Spoiled Child, is that even people who are liberal on other political issues suddenly sound like they're on Fox News when the conversation turns to children or parenting. For example, the whole education establishment is just swooning with a kind of uncritical excitement about the idea of grit or persistence, which is really just recycled notions we got from Aesop's fables and Benjamin Franklin's aphorisms and the idea of, you know, if at first you don't succeed. In other words, rather than questioning the structures, the systems in which kids are put in families and schools and elsewhere, and asking whether what they've been given to do is worth doing, we ignore that and just try to fix the kid who understandably often resists doing it. Tell the kid you've got to show more grit, more self-discipline, more self-regulation. And that's all of a piece with this criticism of kids for feeling too good about themselves, or the idea that that parents are not letting kids fail and feel frustration in a way that's magically supposed to create resilience and prepare them for the tough real world. Underlying a lot of this is a phenomenon I've come to call Bagudi, which is an infelicitous acronym for better get used to it, where the premise is, you know, life when you're an adult is miserable. So to prepare you, we have to make sure you're pretty damn miserable as a child, too.
I hear another kind of argument, though. I hear the argument that people sometimes, they talk a lot about rigor and they talk about the necessity to go through failures in order to really appreciate what you can be successful at, that it's a kind of trial and error, and that, you know, failure and the notion of failure can shape us. I mean, let's talk, for example, about, because I know you're right about dodgeball as being maybe a bad thing, like timeouts and things of that sort. Kids are targets mm-hmm. in dodgeball. But athletics, so the argument goes, can make kids competitive. They can make them understand sportsmanship and, I mean, the best of athletics, and can also be good in terms of teamwork and all that. And the result can be often success. I mean, the Olympics, there are those who fail and win the gold medals as opposed to those who don't. And I think the argument you often hear is it's a competitive world out there. You have to learn how to take your lumps. Yeah.
Right. That's the Bagudi argument. You know, life is unpleasant. And so we're going to immerse you in unpleasantness now to get you ready. I think you're right about one part of what you've said, which is that making kids compete, which is to say putting them in activities where one can succeed only at the price of other people's failure, may well succeed in making kids competitive. But does it create teamwork? No. What it creates is a notion that the only reason to work in a team is to defeat another team. In other words, that cooperation is just the means. Victory is always the end. Competition socializes kids to believe that's inevitable and desirable. But it doesn't create other, I would argue, more desirable goals, which can be accomplished in ways that are less punitive and more supportive, such as cooperation and how to do it, or preparing for the fact that sometimes things in life don't go your way. The way to prepare kids for that is to, A, explain to them and show them how unfortunate things often happen and we don't always get what we hope for, rather than immersing them in that situation, and B, giving kids the kind of support that helps them to see themselves as potentially successful. What tends to best prepare kids for dealing with unpleasant experiences is a chance to feel confident and competent, not repeated exposure to failure, let alone the uniquely unpleasant form of failure in which I fail so that you can succeed. That turns out not to be very helpful at all in terms of helping kids to prepare for what's coming and helping them, and here's a point that's always left out of these diatribes, preparing them to evaluate critically and change aspects of our society, our workplaces and schools and families that we don't find productive.
Alfie Cohen is with us again. His book is The Myth of the Spoiled Child. He's an author of many other books as well about kids and about learning. And let me really go to the heart of this sense of, what I think, you know, you're getting at here in terms of making us aware of the importance of such things as cooperation and everything. What about parents who are simply too involved with their kids, who say, well, I want to be friends with my kid and I want my kid to accept me as a friend. I'll smoke dope with them or her or whatever. I mean, or even just help them with their homework and remove obstacles from their way, shield them from failure. Is this a concern?
Well, you've bundled a bunch of different possibilities there together that I think need to be teased apart. If a parent really wants to be the child's friend and not the parent, smoking dope with them, I find that a problem. But most of the time when that accusation is made, I'm not always sure that what's going on is troubling. I think it may say more about the perspective and values of the observer who wants an old-fashioned, top-down, authoritarian approach to parenting. And if the parent isn't determined to control the child, then the parent is accused of wanting to be the child's friend.
No, but in so many cases, excuse me, you know, the parent just wants to exercise what may be his or her maturity and understanding that comes from experience and say, you're a child, I'm your parent, I love you. I know what's best for you, perhaps in this situation. Another situation, I may not, but in this situation, I can tell that your behavior is a problem or something along those lines, as opposed to, you know, I'm your friend and it's okay to, you know, take crack cocaine or whatever. I don't know.
Right. No, we can always come up with extreme cases where I would certainly say, I think the parent needs to be the parent. But when I hear people use that expression, sometimes you just have to be the parent, more times than not, I'm hearing the parent offer a justification for a type of parenting that's more about doing to than working with. So, yes, there are examples where I think you and I would be in agreement. But I think there are many other examples where that same rhetoric is used to kind of rationalize a bad form of parenting. Ultimately, while parents have to use their wisdom and offer guidance, ultimately, you know, kids learn to make good decisions by making decisions, not by following directions. And I think parents who, for their own emotional reasons, need to be in control of their children are doing their children a disservice and justifying it as being in their child's best interest. So there are plenty of examples of parents who do this sort of thing. But when overparenting exists in a way that I would find troubling, it's not a symptom of indulgence. It's a newer version of control, which I think is precisely what's done kids a disservice for decades.
You don't like timeouts, I said earlier. Why?
Timeout is, first of all, a way of saying, I'm going to forcibly isolate you when you need me the most. It's a form of punishment that, in effect, makes children suffer more emotionally than physically, in the case of spanking, in order to try to change the child's behavior. But making kids suffer never helps them to think about the kind of people they want to be, only what's going to happen to them if their actions meet with a parent's disapproval. So ironically, the same people who complain that kids today are self-centered should never be using punishment that gets kids focused even more on the impact of their actions only to themselves, never to others. And the second reason I don't like them is because timeouts are a form of conditional acceptance from the eyes of the child. They're getting the message, I have to comply with whatever my parent wants, regardless of whether it's reasonable. Otherwise, my parent literally turns off the love and attention. And that's exactly the opposite of what kids need when they screw up. They need to know that we're there for them in all senses of that phrase, even when they screw up, maybe especially then.
What do you think, or what's your response to this Malcolm Gladwell notion in his last book that it's good for kids to overcome liabilities and failures in many instances? In fact, he argues that it can lead to extraordinary success.
There are cases when that happens, although we always want to look at what success means. When people are interviewed, having said they overcame tremendous adversity and became a big success in life, sometimes they became a big success only in the sense that they made a lot of money, not in the sense that they have any real moral compass or are psychologically centered. But many, many more people are faced with adversity and aren't able to overcome, and those people never get interviewed. So the reality is, and here we do have good psychological data, that success is much more likely to predict a future success than is failure, because the main message that kids take from when they failed, more under certain circumstances than others, which I lay out in the book, but the main message they take from that is, I'm potentially a failure, and it makes more sense for me not to extend myself and risk my reputation, so I'm going to play it safe. That's the message that most failure teaches. So I think failure is terrifically overrated for reasons that have to do more with our ideology about success than with what good psychological research says is, in fact, likely to conduce to future success.
Alfie Cohen is with us. His book is The Myth of the Spoiled Child, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom About Children and Parenting, and we'll bring you into this conversation. I want to just get your response, though, Alfie Cohen, to The millennials, we hear a lot of it's anecdotal about millennials facing trouble when they enter the workplace. The story goes that they're so used to getting praise and being told that they're special that they feel above doing the kind of grunt work that's needed in the beginning of their careers, and that they're entitled. This is what we hear, and a lot of people complain about this. It is the only generation that has grown up with the internet and has grown up with, the millennials particularly have grown up with the internet and social networking. But I'm wondering if you think there's anything to this idea. Are adults simply wrong about millennials?
They have enough examples to support the bias they had going in, just as baby boomers were accused by their parents of turning their backs on hard work, and just as the baby boomers turned around and made similar complaints about Gen Xers, and Gen Xers did it about whatever came next, you know, we lose all perspective and become amnesiacs, thinking this is the generation that's really gone bad. And it's not a coincidence that every single article you'll find with those assertions about growing up having been spoiled and things are too easy and now they don't want to do work, there's no data whatsoever, only anecdotes carefully chosen and repeated in a media echo chamber, and quotations from therapists and other journalists who agree with the writer. I mean, I've gone through these articles systematically. There's no evidence to support any of those claims. Besides, what we're doing is generalizing about a cohort that's about 80 million young people. The variations in attitudes, values, work ethic, and so on, variations within each cohort is far greater than any difference you could point to between one cohort and another. But the question I'm always faced with is, why are we so willing to believe these generalizations that almost always depend on disparagement of the younger generation? What purpose does that serve psychologically and otherwise for the people who are doing the disparaging?
Well, one thought I have just off the top of the head is there's always generational gaps, and there's always the notion somehow that generations fall into, well, categories that allow themselves to be open to facile generalizations about, I mean, there was the lost generation, there was the 60s generation, and so forth. It just seems time-worn that one generation will look at another and make assumptions.
Yeah, I think you're right. And to the extent that's true, it undercuts the claim to external validity of all of these generalizations, including the ones that that you've just aptly summarized. But we don't have that sense of perspective, you know, of going back. That's why I start the book by offering these kind of claims in more general terms, and the claims that are contrasted with the good old days, you know, when we were growing up. And then I back up a couple of decades to find that people were saying exactly the same thing then. And then I go back another couple of decades and so on. When you see this evidence of historical continuity, it ought to make the people saying this about the millennials sit down and shut up.
All right. We're coming up on a break, and I want to give the phone number. I also want to ask you about the marshmallow test, because you write a lot about that.
Good.
And we've got a listener who says you must be from another planet. There is plenty of data and research. We'll go into that when we return. But let me give the phone number to you listeners who may want to join this conversation. We do welcome your participation. Questions and comments are invited. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us now. Again, toll-free 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. We'll return with Alfie Cohn. His new book is The Myth of the Spoiled Child. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with author and educational theorist Alfie Cohn, who once again is going against the grain. There was an article I happened to read in Tablet which said he's a contrarian, and here he's perhaps standing, well, not necessarily with the majority, saying that what everyone says about today's kids being spoiled and entitled is simply not true. And there is a set of complaints that we hear a lot about young people these days, that they are entitled, they're overpraised, they grow up thinking they're more special than they really are. And in his new book, The Myth of the Spoiled Child, says These kind of barbs leveled at permissive parents and the supposedly narcissistic kids they raise are unfounded. He says parents should indeed work to raise kids with high self-esteem, and says that the fashionable belief that kids must develop grit and self-discipline through failure and suffering is unproven and, frankly, often unproductive. Getting a lot of responses, and by the way, you can join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, or our Facebook page. Here's Hannah on Facebook, who says, excellent show, cutting through the nonsense. Thank you, Hannah. And let me go to a couple of emails here. Michael says, I think it's important to differentiate between giving kids a lot of positive time and attention versus indulging every whim. I don't think you can give a kid too much love. Although I remember my mother's words, too much of anything is no good. Here's Gerald, who writes, perhaps I'm being too even-handed, but I think that both methods and all others have their dangers. Unearned and unmerited esteem can provoke shameless entitlement and the conviction that the world and we are playthings. Education through failure can teach that when we're nothing but a failure and the world an implacable enemy and an invincible one. And here's the email I alluded to before we went to the break. This is Joe, who says, sorry, your guest is way off. Has your guest read Nurture Shock and the latest research in child development? There is plenty of research and data available. What planet does this guy live in? Does he even have kids? Nurture Shock, by the way, includes a chapter on that famous marshmallow test. And he has, that is, you, Alfie, have plenty to say about that test. So let's go to it.
First, let me just say about Nurture Shock. Nurture Shock, as a book, reminded me of what somebody said about Time magazine a long time ago, which is that they do a great job of covering stuff except the stuff you happen to know something about. So I read the chapters about
Can I just come in here with Bertrand Russell's great comment about Time magazine?
What's that?
Time and Life were both owned by the Luce Corporation. He said Time is for the people who can't think and Life for the people who can't read.
I did.
But I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, my point here is that on the chapters where I happen to know the research dealing with self-esteem, I think they got it completely wrong and were driven by biases that then showed up in the co-author's op-ed later, making the same unfounded claims about kids getting trophies without having defeated anybody and so on. There's no good data to support that. The marshmallow stuff, well, these days, everybody knows that 40 years ago, Walter Mischel at Stanford brought little kids in, and they had to choose between having a marshmallow or a pretzel now or waiting for two later. And those who waited, who had the self-control, could defer gratification, were much more successful in life. Except that's not really what the study showed at all. What they showed was that the situational differences in how each experiment was set up had much more of an effect on which kids could wait than anything within the child. And what turned out to be most successful in helping the kids to wait was helping them to distract themselves with something fun so they didn't have to show self-control, or as he put it, self-denial and grim determination. If you know Walter Mischel's research before this, you know that he believes there isn't a consistent integrated personality that we have independent of the situations we find ourselves in. Rather, we're shaped by those situations. And so conservatives have used the marshmallow experiment, dragging it out of context, to say that what we need is good old-fashioned self-control, and that's what helped kids to be successful. That's not what he found at all, and I go into it in more detail. Plus, the premise of all of the descriptions of this study are that it's always better to wait. But that's not always true. Sometimes it's actually better to take what you can get now, especially if you've been raised in an environment where it's not particularly rational to assume that you'll get more later by waiting.
And by the way, we did discuss Nurture Shock with authors Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman on Forum. You can find that interview, I believe, in our archives. We're going to go to our calls here. Just for the record, though, you were asked if you have kids, Alfie?
I have two, yes.
Okay, then let me go to our callers. We begin, Joe, with you. Good morning.
Hi, yes, good morning. Just wanted to, bring to connect a few dots here that seems to be missing in the conversation. We know that success is something that is achieved through perseverance, hard work. Success doesn't come easy, no matter what the endeavor is, artistic, sports, professional life. And when kids are promoted to feel good about themselves without trying hard, they stop trying hard. And by definition, they stop being, they stop persevering. They lose their ability to withstand defeat and get up again and do it again and try again. If we just keep praising them every time they do something and, oh, you're wonderful, they will learn not to work hard. And working hard, in my view, is what gets you success. I've seen this with my kids and my kids' friends, and some of them are really resilient when they fail at soccer or at school, and some of them just fall apart at the first sign of failure. And I don't think it's a matter of genes. I think there's something in the way that they're being raised, not just by their parents, but by the teachers and their friends, that they're internalizing the message that they're good no matter what. And if something doesn't go right, they just fall apart.
Yeah, Joe, thank
I
you for
the
your
argument.
Comments. Alfie Cohen, that is the argument that Alfie Cohen countervails.
Exactly.
But what about, he's mentioned resiliency again. I mean, this is what one continues to hear, and I think in many instances, in fact, I can't help having a little perverse thought here that many kids want to prove themselves because they're told that they're less than they think they are. And so that becomes, I mean, you have so many adult stories about, you know, he said I couldn't do the work, she said I was inferior, whatever. And so they spend often a lifetime proving that person wrong.
Well, when the people spend a lifetime doing that, they may reach success in some narrow endeavors, but at an enormous emotional cost. Most of this discussion is framed in terms where all that matters is the outcome. All that matters is getting the A or the high-paying job, for example, there. Those people are successful. But some of these people are psychological basket cases, desperately trying to prove their own competence to fill a bucket that has a hole in the bottom because their background has been conditional acceptance or an experience of failure. Those are the success stories, but they're not really that successful when you broaden your definition of success. But second, even with respect to this narrow definition of success, the caller offers a testable hypothesis that success doesn't come easy, although it comes a lot easier to some people than it does to others, and at some things than at other things. And that if you get kids feeling too good about themselves, or they succeed too easily, or they get a trophy when they didn't win, they will stop trying. That's a perfectly reasonable hypothesis for which there is zero supporting evidence. That's why you never hear evidence cited. Let me suggest an example of a psychological study, one of many that I cite in the book, to try to support what I think is true. When you give children a task where they're unable to succeed by design, because that's the way the task was set up, though they aren't told that, and then later you give them a task at which they are capable of succeeding, the kids who got the impossible task and were made to fail earlier are far more likely to give up even at the task where they are capable of succeeding. Because what's most likely to lead kids to throw up their hands isn't success that came too easily, but failure that helped change their sense of who they are. Part of the problem here is our tendency to focus only on behavior that can be seen and measured, such as how well did you do on this task? But the reality is that what leads to or predicts to future events is not the behavior that occurred earlier, but the goals and attitudes and perspectives of the children. And those goals, attitudes, and perspectives are framed by experiences in a way that runs counter to the pick yourself up and try harder next time little engine that could myth that for various reasons continues to drive our culture and leads me to ask the Latin question, cui bono, who benefits from that narrative?
I'm also wondering, since we're talking a lot about self-esteem here, you may recall, Alfie Cohen, that John Vasconcellos, who was a politician here in California, started that whole self-esteem movement, and Gary Trudeau and Doonesbury did some ridiculing of it.
Lampooned it mercilessly.
And so we've come maybe to a point now where do you think it's coming back because of people like yourself who are trying, because it did get a lot of disdain?
I was unable to find in researching this book a single article written in the last 30 years about children and self-esteem, especially in prestige journals like The Atlantic and The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine, that took any view of self-esteem except the conservative view that it comes too easy to kids, they have too much, and what they really need is self-discipline. Now, I think that some of the stuff that was done in schools in the early 90s where kids, you know, chanted, "I'm special," is pretty silly. Some of the self-esteem programs actually work when they're done responsibly, it turns out. But the counter-reaction, the conservative backlash to it, started instantly and continues to this day, disproportionate to the actual movement, which has faded. It's really interesting because I think far more troubling than a silly, overuse of or reliance on self-esteem as a panacea. Far more troubling to that is the attack on self-esteem and especially on the notion of self-esteem as something that shouldn't have to be earned that now has led a lot of parents and teachers to the point where they feel constrained from pointing out that a given structure or situation makes kids feel lousy about themselves, even when that's accurate and worth being concerned about.
We go to more of your calls. We welcome Patrick. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Dr. Cohen. I just want to say it's an honor to listen to you and to talk to you. I'm a community college teacher, and though a lot of your research is about younger kids, it completely applies all the way up through the students that I teach. So I really appreciate the things you've done.
Thank you.
This is a very timely and interesting discussion. This weekend, my wife and son, who's six, and I did a little kids' grand fondo. It was a little 4-mile bike event. They didn't call it a race. It was an event. And we rode from our house. It was about 9 miles round trip, and that was huge for my son. Very fun. At the end, there was a climbing wall. And he wanted to go up the climbing wall, and he tried and tried and tried to get about two-thirds of the way up, and he couldn't do it. There was just, you know, he was just too short, and there was too big of a reach. And I think we live a pretty balanced life. I don't necessarily think that, I for sure don't think that wanting him to fail is a great thing for him. That just seems absurd, so I agree with you on that. And yet sometimes the kids are going to fail. And he just couldn't do it. And so when he came down, I mean, he tried 10 times. One time, I don't know if you've ever been climbing, but he must have hung on that wall for 7 or 8 minutes. I mean, how he did it was beyond me. And so when he came down, we were very much, you know, it's okay to cry. You're disappointed. When people are disappointed, you cry. I think that's a valid emotion. But what was a little disconcerting to my wife and I was that things that my son was saying, it was going into his self-worth, you know, kind of he said, well, I'm bad or whatever, and it's totally out of character because it's not the way he is, and it was kind of shocking for us that the failure to get up the climbing wall was actually turning into a judgment upon himself. So the fact that kids are going to fail completely out of our control, what do you have any suggestion of what might we have said? I mean, he tried a bunch of times, you know, we praised him for that, and we acknowledge his pain for in disappointment. But
no, I think we get the question here, Patrick, and thank you for raising it. Go to Alfie Cohen.
You know, I want to be clear, I'm not arguing in favor of praise, because I think praise often tends to be a way of controlling kids, just like other rewards and punishments. I'm simply challenging the conservative critique of praise, which says we should make it more difficult for kids to earn that praise, which I think is exactly what's wrong. I'm interested in why he wanted to try that hard. It might have been a fine thing to show that kind of perseverance, but it may have been driven by a kind of compulsiveness where he wasn't going to feel good about himself if he didn't succeed. Again, I'm more interested in the motive than in the behavior. I'm more interested in what's going on with your son than I am with celebrating persistence regardless of the context or the reasons for it or at what he's trying to persist, because some things are frankly not worth persisting at. So if the message I would want to give him is, you tried really hard, why was it so important to you to get over that wall? And I would be really interested in listening to what he said and what was between the lines. And I would want to give him the message that of unconditional support, not in a way that's instrumental, that's intended to make him try hard at everything for the rest of his life, no matter what, but to let him know that even when he doesn't succeed, that doesn't diminish his standing in our eyes at all. That's what kids need for psychological sustenance, but it's also, ironically, what's more likely to lead them to try harder next time. And the research shows that. Kids with more unconditional support for who they are tend, on the one hand, to persist longer at difficult tasks, and second, are more able to disengage from impossible tasks than people who feel the need desperately to succeed even when they can't.
Well, apropos of our last call, I'm looking at a listener who writes on our website, the comments from this listener, who writes, the problem is not with rewarding children for trying even if they lose, but children are not learning how to deal with failure and do better next time. Basic social etiquette is also seriously lacking. Many kids I see today break into tears at every small thing that doesn't go their way. This can't be good for children in today's diverse world and a competitive global economy. So maybe we get to the question of what builds kids' resilience?
Well, if we're sacrificing kids' emotional health to what builds a competitive economy, we're all in real trouble. If the word etiquette is being invoked, that suggests that the crying just annoys the writer, as opposed to there's some real anguish here. What can we do to address that? But there's no evidence that kids break into tears when they don't succeed more in 2014 than they did in 1954. And there's always a lot of variation depending on temperament, the personality of the child. I'll tell you this, though. The more a child feels a need to please the parent because the parent's approval is contingent on success, the more unhappy children you're going to have.
Well, another listener writes, speaking of etiquette, I'm afraid that children are not being brought up to be empathic to the needs of others. For example, parents have not taught their children to give up their seats on buses and BART to seniors and disabled on buses and trains. I think there's self-absorption and self-regarding on the part of young parents and their children.
And that's what our parents' generation said about us.
But no, actually, my parents' generation said, give up your seat for an older person, because that was how I was raised.
Well, they may have said to do that, but they complained that not enough people of our generation were doing it because we were selfish. In other words, those complaints are always made about older people, made by older people about younger people, but are confused with a cohort critique that kids today are worse than kids were years ago, when that's not really true. Now, I'm less concerned about mandating specific behaviors that are polite and more concerned about raising kids who are truly empathic from the inside out, because they're concerned about the older person who has to stand on the bus or about the person who doesn't have enough to eat. You can't create generosity and empathy by coercing children into certain behaviors of which we approve. In fact, it works the other way around.
Sometimes a thin line, though, between coercion and showing approval or trying to at least
yes, that's right.
Instruct the child in terms of what is right.
Go ahead. But I take that the other way around, that sometimes we control kids with a kind of psychological control in which we control with guilt or disappointment that's no less controlling and no less and probably more destructive. And then if we raise a child authentically to be concerned about the needs of someone else so they will voluntarily be committed to the notion of wanting to help people feel better. Ironically, the old school, you'll do it because I said so, undermines that concern about others because kids are so busy trying to meet their own emotional needs and win that impossible love and approval from a parent who may actually be dead by now that they're no longer attentive to the real needs of other people around them.
Or they're rebellious against that authoritarian voice that can stay in their head for a lifetime. Let me bring another caller on here. And Jane, that's you. Hi, Jane.
Hi there. My six-year-old daughter has become a complete contrarian over the last few months. Anything we say we like, she immediately says, oh, no, I don't like that. I hate that. And I've been fine with that because I thought she was, you know, separating herself from us. But lately it's been doubled with these terrible, seemingly completely irrational, out-of-the-blue tantrums. And I've enjoyed and appreciated and agreed so much with what you were saying that all of a sudden I was so ashamed when you said that we should not be doing timeouts because that is how we've been treating them. How would you suggest I stop, I let her know that it's not okay to kick and scream and yell without making her feel like I'm taking away my unconditional love?
Right. Time out, like other punishments and rewards, makes kids more self-centered and more likely to fear you than to see you as a caring ally. When a child is having a tantrum, something is going on, and your main goal here is to make sure that nobody, including her, gets hurt, but then try to respond to the underlying needs that are driving this, which you can't do at the time of the tantrum. What I would try to focus on is, if you're screaming at other people or hurting them, look at the effect this is causing them and doing that in a way that's not punitive or humiliating. As opposed to, when you do this, you make me unhappy, or I get mad at you, or I'm going to separate you from me. That makes kids worse, which is why punishment leads to more tantrums. Time out leads to exactly the problem that tended to lead to them in the first place.
Well, let me wish Jane good luck and thank her for the call. I just want to also remind listeners that you're listening to Forum and we're talking with Alfie Cohen. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll bring another caller in this. And that's you, Nat. You're on. Hi.
Hi, gentlemen. Good morning. Alfie, you seem to see things in a black and white manner as well. You know, either there's no difference, there's absolutely no differences, and I don't know. I hear biases too. But anyway, my point is, when I grew up in the 60s and the 70s as a kid, we were left to our own devices most of the time. I mean, sure, the discipline was maybe a little more stern, but we created our own. When we went outside, we were gone for the day. We made our own teams. We failed on our own. We helped each other. We fought with each other. I participated in my childhood most, you know, with my peers more than now. I mean, with our daughters, I mean, there's been a scheduling everything and which is fine. We have a different relationship. I didn't have with my parent. You know, my parents later in the later years, which my dad would say, you know, he felt bad about, you know, not spending a lot of time or I mean, he, and so there's been trade-offs. Obviously, we have a better relationship with our kids than I did with my parents. But we have benefits that I don't see in children in adults that are now that were raised in this last generation. So there is a trade-off. It's not a black or white thing.
I feel like I'm the one who's challenging the black and white notion based on just looking at behavior or simplistic generalizations about an entire generalization. My view throughout this whole book is it's more complicated than that. And I think that applies to the example you've offered as well. When in the good old days, we were left to our own devices. There were some good things about that to the extent it was really more true then than now, and some bad things about that. Some of what was going on was bullying that children were left to try to deal with on their own, using exactly the same rationale that's still used now with a lot of things that we don't want helicopter
parents. Forgive me, Alfie,
but
children were a lot freer. I mean, you know, there's a great deal of concern now, some say excessive, but nevertheless real because of child abductions and things along those lines, which maybe make parents much more protective or more helicopterish or whatever you want to define it as.
Right. There is more of that. And the helicopter parent down the street is doing things that when I do with my kid, hypothetically, is showing love. So it depends on the perspective of whether it's excessive, whether it's a problem. I don't take an absolute position on, and I don't think anybody should, about when parents should get involved and how much freedom kids should have to do things on their own. It depends on a lot, including the kid's personality and needs individually, as well as the situation and what the objective risk is.
Well, along those lines, I'm looking at a comment from a listener named Bridget who says, is there only one type of child? These studies seem to ignore the possibility of children having different wiring and therefore may bring different things to the table before the studies even begin.
Well, and different, more importantly, different
parents.
Cultural backgrounds and different parents. Oh, yeah. That's why I think during this hour I've probably used you know, there are variations within, you know, or phrasing like that many times. A lot of it depends. That's why, for example, research finds that some kids need a lot more support than others when they go away from home, for example, if they go to college. Research has found that children who are the first in their families to go to college need a lot more parental support, and sometimes more than they're getting. So the one-size-fits-all denigration of helicopter parents is based on a single model, which is usually a model that's Western more than Eastern, middle class more than working class, white more than people of color, and so on.
Well, as long as we're talking about cultural differences, let me just read another website comment, which I think will strike you. Wesley writes, the discussion is about American children. My children have a French curriculum education. Teachers pass out grades in front of students, call the students' names, making certain the kids are not necessarily special, etc. Yes, it's harsh, but the kids know it's only talk, and they suck it up. They make fun of American parents. They make fun of American parents and teachers who are so nice and goody-goody. As one of my children now enters the Air Force Academy, I know she'll have no problems with drill instructors.
Oh, boy. Certainly been prepared for drill instructors. Whether that means it's in the best interest of the child or our culture, I don't know. Whenever I hear people say proudly or with a kind of self-satisfaction, the kids suck it up and they're better for it, it makes me shiver, because the children often tell a different story, if not now, than to their therapists later.
We'll leave it there. Alfie Cohen, good to have you with us on Forum. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alfie Cohen's book, The Myth of the Spoiled Child, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom About Children and Parenting. You can discuss, continue this discussion online simply by going to kqed.org/forum. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can also email us and let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear, kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.